Going to start the meeting now. We don't have a quorum yet, but in the interest of honoring those who have come on time, I want to get started. We're not going to take up initiative and referendum immediately because of the lack of a quorum, so I'm going to change the order a little bit, and we'll take up Mr. Reinhold's the agriculture and environment overview, and then I'm guessing maybe about 1:30. By then we'll certainly have a quorum and people here. We can go back to INR then. So that's the plan. I'll officially convene the meeting when we have a quorum. With that, unless there are questions, Mr. Reinholz, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Chairman Knobloch, members of the committee, thank you. Jim Reinholz, fiscal analyst with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. So my responsibilities include the Ag, Environment, Natural Resources, Finance area, which is what I'm here today to give you an overview on. You should have a package that the cover letter is Ag, Environment, Natural Resource Finance. I'm going to be referring to that as I go through my presentation. So if you would turn to that and follow along, it might help the committee as I go through some of the financial specifics of this area. On the first, the first page, obviously the cover page. If you turn to the second page, what I've listed here is the agencies or organizations that come underneath the jurisdiction of the Ag, Environment, and Natural Resource Finance Committee. And I just wanted, most of you are probably familiar with most of these, but there are some that are relatively small and might be unknown, and I just wanted to mention some specific things about them. The first one being the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. If you're not familiar with that, that is a private, it was created in statute, although it is a private nonprofit. That is funded through general fund dollars and has been since the late 80s. The Ag Department, you're obviously aware of. Animal Health Board is a small agency who is responsible for guaranteeing and the health of the animals in the state, both the domestic animals and those animals that are used in commercial farming and livestock operations. It is governed by an independent board and is the board is appointed by the governor. The Horticultural Society is listed here. This is another one. There's a private nonprofit. There were currently not funding that. It's still listed as under the purview of this committee because of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee because it is still in statute. The Environmental Assistance Office is an agency that is in the news this year, so to speak. It is being proposed to be merged with the PCA and the governor's recommendations. The Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, most of you are familiar with that. That is the Legislative Commission that makes recommendations on the Environmental Trust Fund dollars. Those are the dollars that come from the lottery. Metro Parks comes underneath this committee. That is the arm of the Met Council that funds both the capital and the operating costs within the Metro Park system. The Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Water Commission is another organization that is not currently active but is still in statute and hence is still carried here. The Minnesota Conservation Corps, this is another example of a private nonprofit organization funded through the committee. It used to be underneath the DNR. It was 2 years ago. It was privatized, so to speak, and it is out as its private a nonprofit corporation now. The Minnesota Zoo is another agency under it. The DNR, of course, is the largest agency. The Pollution Control Agency comes under the committee. The Science Museum of Minnesota is another example of a private nonprofit that's been funded by this committee for years. Voyageurs National Park is another one that's currently not funded but does exist in statute. And the Water and Soil Resources Board is the final agency listed. This one, once again, is governed by a board. The board is appointed partly in statute. It's made up of some commissioners and water and local officials. What I wanted to say at this point was just a few of the trends that are going on in the area. In Environment and Natural Resources has been influenced lately over the last few years by a growing population. This population obviously puts more stress and use on the resources and also at the same time creates more pollution. It also means a continuation of a fragmentation of the natural habitats and loss of agricultural land. Those trends have been concerns in the last few bienniums, and I expect it will be going forward. Beyond just these trends, there's been increasing complexities in some of the problems being faced in the area, particularly in the area of pollution. Pollution problems are no longer concentrated in the large polluters, such as factories or the water treatment plants that we had concentrated on in the past. Now it is primarily considered the biggest problems are non-point solution. Those are car exhaust, stormwater, and ag runoff are examples of that type of pollutants. Those pollutants also that are threatening human health are considerably smaller than they used to be in the past as far as particles or the discharges. In agriculture, you're aware there are more exotic diseases going on out there these days that they are much more concerned of. Recent ones are the Asian flus that we've been dealing with, not yet in Minnesota, but in some other parts of the country. You may have just heard in the news where Ag Department confiscated a large amount of illegal chicken farts that had been brought in from Southeast Asia because of the fear of the avian flu coming from that area. Also, obviously, given the fact that nearly half the budget in the ag and natural resources areas from the general fund and the fact that the state's revenue structure in the last few years has caused some reduction in those funds, that has also been a prime challenge for this area, as it has in most of the other areas. Those are just a few of the real overall general trends going on. If you would turn to the next page, it should be a pie chart, allocation of general fund resources by bill. This is based on the November forecast. I just wanted to give you a sort of picture of where ag and environment fits into the general fund budget. I'm not even sure what color the ag one is because it's such a small slice there. I can't see the color on the chart, but as you would see the numbers, it's 0.3% of the general fund budget. That is about $80 million for the biennium. The environment that is just below it, that is sort of the dark red color, it's 1.1% of the general fund budget for the biennium in the base. That's in dollar terms, $336 million. So you can see in terms of the state's general fund budget, ag and environment are very small pieces of that total dollars being spent. If you would go to the next chart, that one being on page 4, this chart indicates the percentage distribution of the 06-07 general fund base between the agencies and the organizations funded by the in the committee. As you can see from the chart, obviously the Department of Natural Resources is the majority, is actually more than 50% of the money. It's the gorilla in the budget. The direct appropriations in the DNR is that light blue down in the sort of the lower right quadrant of the circle is 40%. Also, the open portion of the Natural Resources Department over on the left lower quadrant is 16%, making up a total of 56% then of the general fund based dollars coming into this division. If you include just the Ag and the DNR, Ag Department is up in the upper left side of that circle. If you include the Ag Department and the DNR, it's 75% of the total general fund based dollars for this committee's jurisdiction. I would then go to the next page. The next page would be a table titled the Fund Balance Statement, November 2004 Forecast Basis. What this table is indicating is the dollar distribution. The previous pie chart was a percentage distribution. This one now is showing the dollar distribution by general fund, and also the bottom half of the table is titled all funds, and indicating those non-general fund dollars that are in this committee. If you look at it, and what I've laid out here is this is now more than just the base budget that the previous pie chart had. This is indicating the actual fiscal year 2003 amounts. It's then moving on to the next biennium, the current biennium, and showing you the 2004-05 forecast amount since we're still in the second year of that biennium. The third column here is showing you the 2006-07 base amounts, and then it's showing a percent change. The next column here is showing the governor's recs for 06, 07 and a percent change back to 2003. Some important trends that I would point out for you, the column titled percent change 02, 03 biennium to the forecast. In the general fund area, you'll see that the general fund has declined by 10.6% in this division from 0203 to the current base forecast. In the governor's recommendations, which is the last column, the decline is 20.6% in the general fund from 0203 to the governor's recommendations for 0607. That's the general fund. The bottom half of the chart indicates all funds for the agencies listed over on the left-hand column. What you'll see there is a little bit different picture. The general fund went down from in the forecast 10%, where all funds has only declined 4.1% from 0203 to the 0607 forecast. And in the governor's recommended budget, the decline is 1% from 0203 to the governor's 0607.
Excuse me, Mr. Reinholz, I got a question. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not on the Agriculture or Environmental Committee, so can I just ask one question?
You absolutely can.
For the governor's proposal, and I know the chair isn't here either, so maybe Mr. Reinholz can answer this. The Office of Environmental Assistance was an office created to be able to help businesses deal with pollution problems. We created it so that the Office of Pollution Control Agency was an enforcement issue, and the Office of Environmental Assistance was a non-enforcement issue, but would come out and say, we're not enforcing the law, we're here to help you deal with some of the technical assistance. And I know that I think that was put in part of the Pollution Control Agency, but the governor's recommendation is 100% reduction in that. Does the governor have any other recommendations for helping businesses deal with pollution, or is it all going to be now in enforcement, or are you not able to answer the question?
Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, in the chart it does show that the governor is recommending 100% reduction in the Office of Environmental Assistance. What is really happening here is his recommendation is to merge the Pollution Control Agency and the Office of Environmental Assistance into a newly created department. The Department of Environmental Protection is the name being proposed for that. Within the specifics of that proposal, there is not a reduction listed in either dollars or activities for the economic for the Office of Environmental Assistance. The information the committee has received so far and has had testimony from the Commissioner Corgan is that they will continue doing those same activities. This is when they have been merged into the new department. So the plan, at least as proposed by the governor, is to continue that.
But there will not be a separate tracking of the monies that go to helping businesses deal with pollution. And is that true, or will we somehow be able to still continue to track how much money is and assistance that businesses are getting to deal with the pollution as opposed to coming down heavy-handedly with an enforcement?
Mr. Reinholz. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that at this time it's proposed in such a way that we will be able to track those. Most of the office is going into one division in the PCA, and the activities at the appropriation and allocation level are not proposed to be changed. I would assume there would probably be some mixing of some of the administrative activities, but I think the direct programmatic activities we would fairly easily be able to track the dollars.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got a couple of other questions, but before I take those, let me officially convene the meeting. The meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. And members, we have the minutes of the March 1st meeting in front of us. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes of the March 1st meeting? Seeing no changes, Representative Sikora moves approval of the March 1st minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. I've got Representative Paymar and Representative Earhart. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reinholz, I'm just a question on the appropriation to the Science Museum of Minnesota. If I'm reading this correctly, the governor is recommending a 50% reduction. And do you know what the impact of this is going to be on the Science Museum?
Chairman Knobloch,
Mr. Reinholz,
Representative Paymar, the reduction that you see at 50% is from the 02-03 biennium to the 06-07. The reduction was made 2 years ago in the biennial budget put together for 04 and 05. The Science Museum went down at that point. There is no additional reduction recommended for this current biennium by the governor.
Okay. And one final question.
Representative Paymar.
Where would we see in this document the producer payments for ethanol production, or wouldn't that show up in this document?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, it is underneath the Agricultural Department's total budget. It is not listed in here in this particular table as an individual item. It is included in the Ag Department's budget. It is general fund appropriation. So on that chart that you were referring to, the Science Museum, up on the top half of it, the general fund amounts, the in the Ag Department's total base of $71 million, the ethanol producer payments are in that amount.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your chart, the Ag Environment General Fund only, what is the 70% for Ag Department direct? What does that mean?
Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, that is the Ag Department is 17% of the general fund base of this committee's budget. That's what I was indicating here. I took the total budget that goes to this in the base general fund base for this committee, the Ag, Environment, Natural Resources. The Ag Department is 17% of that. That 17% translates into $71 million over the biennium.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is that for the operations of the Ag Department?
Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, members, it is for the operations of the Ag Department and the ethanol payments. And the ethanol payments, producer payments, are a significant portion of that budget in, I'm quickly trying to look it up here, in the 06-07 budget, out of that $70 million, $34 million of it is ethanol payments.
34.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hart,
is that in one of your columns of figures somewhere, or
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Reinholz,
Representative Earhart, it is included in the Ag Department total. It is not broken out as a separate item.
All right, Mr. Reinholz, please continue.
I think then I would move on to the next table. That one is titled up in the top, the Ag, Environment, Natural Resources, and Finance 06-07 Budget Summary by Fund. This is really the summary from my spreadsheet that we use for tracking it, and I put it in here just to make a few comments on the complexity of the budget in this area. As you can see, the funds are listed, that column A are all the different sources of funding that come into this the agencies in this area. And as you can see, it includes a large number of funds, most of which you probably have heard of, may not know the specifics on the general fund. Obviously, the Petroleum Tank Release Fund, State Government Fund, Environmental Fund, Remediation Fund, the Natural Resources Fund, the Game and Fish Fund, the Future Resources Fund, and Environmental Trust Fund are all the direct funds. The bottom half of this table lists those funds that are either open appropriations or statutory appropriations. So you can see there's a large number of those also. Many of them the same funds, just also open or statutory, including the Natural Resources, Game and Fish, State Government Fund, Environmental Fund, Remediation Fund. And I wanted to mention that, you know, appropriations made in statute are often fundamental and ongoing spending commitments on the state. They're generally forecasted amounts. They're based on levels of activity often. And in the general fund, you'll see this area, there's $64 million worth of open appropriations in the base request. $25 million of that approximately is payment in lieu of taxes, payments that are made. $19 million is firefighting activity, and approximately $15 million is payments to Indian tribes for treaty rights settlements that have been made over the years. The other statutory and open appropriations money includes the federal money, fee money from special revenue accounts, the remediation fund dollars that are spent on environmental cleanup, the ag fund that is raised from all the various ag fees and services. The Game and Fish Fund includes numerous statutory appropriations on license fees, and the Environmental Fund, which collects pollution control fees, it contains numerous statutory references. Most of this money has restrictions on how it may be spent that are go beyond easy changes, and they're in statute primarily and controlled by the legislature in that way. For example, the agricultural fund monies are mostly payments for the cost of specific services provided by the Department of Agriculture, whether that be coming out and doing dairy diagnostics activities or coming out and doing health and some of the health and safety inspections that they do on farms. Fishing fees and pollution control fees have obligations on them beyond specific guidelines placed on the dollars in statute. They are really fiduciary funds in some ways. As you can see, it's a very complex budget. That's why I included it here. One number I would point out is in the base budget, total budget is estimated at $1.083 billion. The total direct is $718 million, so about 66% of this budget is direct. The remainder of it is either open or statutory. Mr. Chairman, I would then move on, and the only other piece that I had in here was I did attach, and I wasn't planning to go through it, but I did attach two pages that were the governor's recommendations, really the governor's summary of his recommendations in this area.
Representative Clark.
Mr. I had a question just before we left that other page on the Environmental Trust Fund. 04 and 05, the numbers are there. There's nothing for 06 and 07. Is that...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, as I said, this is off of the spreadsheet that I do the tracking. And the 04 and 05, the Environmental Trust Fund are the dollars that are recommended for expenditures by the LCMR, and then the committee approves it and the legislature approves it. There is no base for that. That is a one-time-only appropriation every year, and that's why it doesn't appear in the base request. And the governor typically does not make recommendations on it, so it does not appear in the governor's request. I am assuming that when the House takes action, they will make recommendations, and there will be expenditures of those dollars.
So, Mr. Chair, you're saying the governor didn't make any statement about the Environmental Trust Fund in his budget?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Clark, he passed on the recommendations of the LCMR really without comment, is the way that they typically were passed on. He did not make changes to them. There have been some proposals. It has not been in part of the governor's rec to make some changes in the LCMR process that did not come over yet as the governor's
position. Okay, I thought there was something. Mr. Chair, if I could, one other question.
Representative Clark.
I came in a tiny bit late, but you were talking about some trends in terms of the public's concern about pollution, I believe.
Mr. Chairman,
is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I just briefly mentioned some of the overall trends that the committee has been dealing with, and that being growing population, which puts pressure both on the use of the resource and also tends to increase pollution, and also has increased the sort of the conversion of natural lands into lands that are utilized by human culture.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Clark.
Maybe I'm remembering this wrong, or I didn't hear it as you meant it, but I thought you were also talking about that there's less concern about some contaminants or smaller...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I think what you're saying, I said that the concerns on pollution have become moved towards the smaller items. It's moved away from the point source pollution that used to be the primary concerns. We have made significant improvements in reducing pollution from point sources over the last 25 years. Those are things like the sewage treatment plants and factories. And now the focus has turned to non-point, which is much smaller sources of pollution. It would be the stormwater runoff that comes from paved areas or agricultural or other man-disturbed areas have become more the focus of pollution control.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
I know probably most people heard the report on the public radio. I think it was an hour-long report about actually some point sources dealing with discharges that have to do with the Kimmelite plant, 3M's plant, and some other investigations that have been gone on, And I was concerned because I see there's cutting here for remediation is doing away with the Office of Environmental Assistance. It seems like, you know, there's evidence that we're not getting, that at least was suggested in that report that maybe some of that evidence is being suppressed or at least not being brought forward. And I'm not asking you to explain that. It's something the agency should explain. But I guess I'm just trying to understand if that trend took into account kind of some of the more recent revelations that we have had just in the last week.
Mr. Reinholz.
Representative Clark, I didn't mean to say that point source pollution is not still addressed. It's just the emphasis. Most of that has had programs in place for numerous years, and I believe the pollution control is addressing that 3M problem, from what I understand. At least, and we do still have in place those programs. It's really the focus is moving on to the non-points pollution because it is less, should we say, it's been less in focus for years, and so we're trying to get at that also in our pollution control in the state.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
At least according to the report, you know, the Pollution Control Agency has transferred the main scientist who was involved with that, and it's kind of turning the research back over to 3M itself and the private sector. So I guess I'm just concerned about these cuts to the budget and losing some of those parts of the agency that maybe a little bit more of a watchdog there, although it sounds like, I don't know. I'm concerned about it. I don't serve on that committee this year, but I guess if I did, I would hopefully maybe that committee will look at that. And this budget is in terms of those cuts seems...
Well, again, Representative Clark, I guess our purpose in doing this today is more historical in terms of looking at what the budget has been, what the budget history has been, as opposed to looking at the governor's proposal. We did have a review of the governor's budget some time ago. I know that they're going to be coming up with a supplemental budget request, I think maybe tomorrow. I anticipate we'll do that one of these coming days. But I think that in terms of the criticism or the advocacy for the governor's proposal, I think that Mr. Reinholz is a nonpartisan staff person, of course, and I don't know that's his job to get into advocating or defending the governor's proposal. Representative Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just curious, in your budget, there's Metropolitan Council Parks. Now, I was curious, in the bonding bill, there was money put in for non-metro parks. Would this money also come under the purview of this department? Would there also be oversight of this department over those dollars?
Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, there is some funding in the DNR for non-metro parks. It is not specific. The bonding bill covers metro parks. There also is a separate item for regional parks and regional trails. So yes, this committee does have, I would have to say, jurisdiction over any dollars proposed or current for parks other than the metro parks.
So there was, in the past, there weren't any dollars for non-metro parks. Is that correct?
Mr. Reinholz, members, there is a small amount of money in the DNR for a grant program that non-metro parks are eligible to apply for. Yes, there is.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know that exact amount, but it is not. It is a relatively small amount.
Okay.
Representative Solberg.
Just one very quick question, and that is in the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Can you give us at some point, if you don't have the numbers now, when we cut out the general fund, how much federal money they may lose from their program. I think sometimes it takes a general fund appropriation to access some other funds, and specifically on that one, I would like to know that if that's in danger of losing other funds because of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I can provide you with that. We did have testimony from the Minnesota Conservation Corps, and I don't believe they specifically mentioned loss of federal funds as an issue with this. They did mention that the general fund dollars were the core dollars that they used for administration of the agency, and then that they contracted often with both DNR and other local governments to do work specifically on work projects, and that was their main concern with the reduction of the general fund dollars proposed.
Mr. Chair, if there is a loss of outside funds, of federal funds or other funds, we appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I will look into that and get back to you.
Good.
Mr. Reinholz, I'm wondering, could you talk a little bit about, it seems like one of the trends that has been happening, at least with the DNR in recent years, and not just the last 2 years, but years before that, is relatively less money coming from the general fund and relatively more money coming from license fees, other special revenue type account sources of money. Can you talk a little about that? Is that happening in other states? What, if anything, is the effect of a switch out of funds like that?
Mr. Chairman, that clearly has been a trend, and it showed up in the numbers when I indicated the change where the general fund had dropped significantly more than the non-general fund. And what has been happening is those areas that are capable of generating a revenue stream outside the general fund have been able to keep up, so to speak, with inflation and increasing costs, and in some cases exceed that where there was activity. Those areas that do not have access because of what they are to non-general fund sources of revenue have then, in most cases, fallen behind. So what really it has done, I think it has somewhat, the availability of funds has really been restricted the ability to make decisions on policy outside of those funds. They're matched together very closely more when general fund isn't available, for example. The water resources area in the DNR is almost all general fund, and they have taken considerable reductions. And where some of the areas, the game and fish can generate additional dollars from their hunting and fishing fees, they have been able to continue to keep up with the increasing costs. That has been really the trend that you've seen over the last three or four biennials.
Okay. And Mr. Reinholz, another issue that I know has been talked about more and more in this committee is the whole issue of direct versus open appropriations and having, you know, maybe license fees instead of directly appropriating the license fees, having them just essentially automatic appropriations that are just usable as they come in without a direct appropriation of them. Can you talk about the effect of that and what effect, if anything, you see happening from moving toward that sort of system?
Chairman Knobloch, that has been a reoccurring issue in this area over decades, I should say. And just as a sort of sidebar to that, I would say that in the late 80s, for example, the Parks Department in the DNR had its own account, the park account within the Natural Resources Fund. And back then, fund consolidation came along in the late 80s, took that out and put the revenue into the general fund and then put also the appropriation in the general fund. And we kind of moved through the 90s that way, and it did that with a lot of these separate accounts. And as the 90s went on, numerous ones came back into special accounts, and the parks was one. So 15 years later, parks is back to where they were in the late 80s, where they are now their own account within the Natural Resources Fund, which is direct but is proposed by the governor to be statutory in this year's budget. The trends seem to come and go in that. I think most people, if you look at the professional information on that, would say it is better for government to have less statutory and open and more direct. I would say that's because people seem to think that it's watched closer. I would have to say this division, during the years I have been on it, track all statutory and open funds in our spreadsheets, not just the direct funds, and do watch those funds. But I believe that the Legislative Commission on, what is it, they used to call it FIPS, Finance and Fiscal Policy.
Plan and Fiscal Policy.
A couple years ago adopted some guidelines based on that. It had some real good information on whether funds should be statutory or direct, and I tend to lean towards that there should be more control by the legislature, which would be direct myself, and that really is how that commission adopted guidelines, saying that they should be direct unless there's a reason not to be.
Okay. Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reinhold, pick out any one of the reductions that you have presented here, or what the governor is proposing on reductions. What takes place in a department or in an agency when, let's say, there's a 12% or 15% reduction? Could you help me with that,
Mr. Reinhold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dempsey, that can vary from department to department in specific reduction. Most reductions that come forth are specifically earmarked. For example, the significant reduction shown between 02 and 03 in the current base in the Ag Department was primarily due to lowering the ethanol producer payments from 20 cents a gallon to 13 cents a gallon. So that was a very specific item. In some instances, there really is an across-the-board cut that the agency deals with. More in is asked to find efficiencies within their organization, and sometimes it's successful, other times cuts activities. So it really varies, but oftentimes there are specific activities discontinued.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Reinhold, I'm sorry, Representative Solberg.
Let me answer the question. Another thing that they do is they close the offices, like in Brainerd, for the DNR, transfer some of those people to St. Paul, and so we have less services out there, and then lay off the foresters.
Mr. Reinholz, can you acquaint me again with the lottery in lieu of? What is that? How much money goes through that, and how is that divided out statutorily?
Mr. Chairman, the lottery in lieu dollars are, as it implies, it's equivalent to the sales tax on the sales of the lottery tickets. It's 6.5% of the sales tax dollars is earmarked. A portion of it goes to the general fund. 72%, in the range of 70-72% right now, is earmarked to be used for specific purposes, half of which goes into the heritage account, which is used for game and fish related activities. The other half of it goes into the natural resources account, the majority of which is split to, I think it's 22% between the metro parks and outstate parks and trails, and that's the portion that I was talking about with Representative Socorro, where it is available for some of the trails in the parks. There is a portion there. There also is a small percentage of it that goes to the zoos in the state. 2% each goes to the three zoos in the state. The total dollar amount, I'm hesitant to say. It is a significant amount of money, and it's not coming to the top of my head at this point. But it, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The DNR is here. Maybe Joe could do it. Do you really want to, Joe?
You know, maybe we can just.
I'll get that.
We can perhaps get that information for me. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Did I see Representative Earhart? Thought I saw a hand over there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious, if we now have half of the direct agriculture budget going for ethanol, and we double the amount of ethanol in the, or double the amount here of ethanol production and all this to meet the requirements of our new proposed ethanol mandate, does that mean we'll also be doubling the direct payments for, or will we be doing more than that? Have we unleashed another monster here that will be eating up our budget at a greater rate than we can raise taxes? Or
Mr. Reinhold.
Mr. Chairman, members, and not without changes to the statutory language. The statutory language restricts new plants coming online, basically, and also has an end date of 2010. In fact, the ethanol subsidy payments are scheduled to decline rather dramatically over the next several years. What's happening is there's a maximum amount that plants can obtain, and there are plants going offline, we're calling it, as they are no longer eligible for the subsidy.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Mr. Reinhardt, if we bring more, we will have to bring more plants online, I assume, if we're going to double the amount necessary to meet the 20% mandate. And if that be the case, then there won't be a decline. There will be at least the same amount or an increase.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Reinhold.
As I indicated, statute would have to be changed because current statute does not allow new plants to come into the program. Obviously, that is eligible for change by decision of the legislature. But under current statute, it will be declining.
And Representative Earhart, I am by no means an expert on this, but my understanding is that I don't believe the governor is recommending any additional subsidies to give people an incentive to provide that additional ethanol. I think that they're expecting that the plants would be built if there was that mandate without additional subsidy, although anyone who has more knowledge in here, please correct me if I'm wrong on that. Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, I think under current law, however, if another plant is built, it's an automatic subsidy. I might be mistaken on this.
Mr. Reinhold?
Representative Solberg, no, current law does not allow new plants to come in.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Reinhold? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Reinhold, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now we'll take up House File 820. Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
The Chair will move that House File 820 be referred to the Committee on Rules without further recommendation. And Representative Paulson, I think you've got a technical amendment, the A1 amendment that you want offered.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That's apparently at the recommendation of counsel. It's purely technical.
Okay. Chair will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Paulson, why don't you tell us about House File 820?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Just to refresh everyone's memory, this is the initiative and referendum ballot reform measure, which the House has actually passed several times in the past years on a bipartisan basis. I'm advocating and moving the bill, the legislation, through the session once again. Let me first say that the bill is identical, actually, to the legislation that we have already voted on or passed several times previously. Let me also point out from the outset that the bill is specifically designed to be not like California, Oregon, Colorado, Arizona, North Dakota, or many other states that have very wide open ballot initiative processes where it make it very easy to get items before the voters, and often can result in ballot clutter. Instead, the bill is designed more like Missouri or, say, Ohio, where it is a tougher standard and the thresholds are there to make it more difficult to bring an item before the voters, because it would have to enjoy true, broad-based, popular support. And I think most of us would recognize that Minnesotans, by their history and tradition and culture, have done a good job when they get mobilized at a grassroots level of bringing issues forward. In fact, historically, if you look at how this bill is modeled over the other states in a similar fashion over the last 104 years, there would likely only be one, possibly two issues that could make it to the ballot every 2 years. So it is a very high threshold or standard to meet. I think that is a very appropriate, it is proper, it is responsible, and very balanced and fair. So you can't just sit out at the Mall of America or in one city in the state and collect signatures to bring an issue for it. It truly does have to demonstrate statewide support by collecting signatures not only from 5% of those who voted in the last gubernatorial election on a statewide basis, but also on a distribution measure of the 6 out of the 8 congressional districts. And so, Mr. Chair, members, I think the reality is that initiative referendum has produced some good laws in our history. It's been brought forward again in 24 other states. 80 of our cities already have this in Minnesota. It's got bipartisan support. It's also supported by several other political parties here in the state, the Reform Party, the Independence Party, the Green Party as well. And I would encourage your support and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Representative Paulson? Representative Reiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, in Texas, they or not Texas, but Florida, where they had the ballot initiative that is costing billions of dollars on school class size, do you envision any checks on that sort of an initiative should this pass in Minnesota?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grayling, there is one provision that we've laid out. Some states, and I'm not aware of Florida in particular in this measure, but some states, such as California, do prohibit the legislature from tinkering or changing law after an initiative is passed. And that's a difference we've built in here. So effectively, there is a sunset measure. So if the people do something, you know, that's viewed as too wild or crazy, or it puts the legislature in a severe box, for instance, then the legislature would have the ability to come forward and readjust or make adjustments to that. I'm not familiar with the Florida provision you specifically mentioned, or if Florida can change that through the legislative process, or if it would require an initiative. But the intent here, members, is to allow the legislature, of course, to have the flexibility to deal with that.
Representative Dreiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, I have an article here from a couple of weeks ago saying Florida voters approved class size limits in 2002 to begin phasing in this year. But by the 2010, once they have it phased in, then elementary class sizes would be limited to 18 students, 4th through 8th grade classes would have 22, and high school classes would have 25. And then according to this article, Governor Bush is saying that this mandate is expected to cost billions of dollars, and so he's trying to get it undone and so forth. So you might want to look into that. I personally don't support initiative and referendum, but you know, some of the things that have been passed under it have actually been, you know, halfway decent things. But I think that you know, here in the legislature, we limit ourselves where we, you know, can't even offer amendments unless we say where the money's coming from. But then we put forward budget-busting things like this that would encumber taxpayers, you know, to spend an awful lot of money without thinking it through, like we're, you know, supposedly supposed to do here at the legislature. I just think it's a slippery slope.
Representative Paulson, just a clarification. If, in terms of changing statute or changing the Constitution, is the required vote 50% plus one of those voting, or is it 50% plus one of those voting on this particular issue?
Mr. Chairman, the provision for a constitutional amendment change would be identical to the threshold that we have today when the legislature places a constitutional amendment on the ballot, where it does require that supermajority status, if you will. For those not voting, it would be counted as a no vote. For the statutory or the referendum provisions, it would be a majority vote.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, let me get this straight. Representative Paulson, did I hear you? The reason why you're bringing this bill forward, you know, it's all, you know, hurrah, hurrah, good government, let the people decide. But then you got a mechanism in your bill that when the people decide, if we all around this table think they got a little too wild and crazy, then the people, what the people decide doesn't make any difference in the end anyway. That's pretty good rational thought, as far as I'm concerned. Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, this is my 19th year in the legislature, and I don't think in 19 years I've had three people tell me they wanted initiative and referendum, so I don't know who you talk to and who I talk to, but we're obviously talking to two different types of folks. But, you know, there's a lot of hardship out there and concern this year particularly, but it's been around since we've been in deficit spending, which is 4 years now. And people are talking about the fact that no money's coming into education. And, you know, I was up at the nursing home three times this weekend when I was home because my mother's there now and my aunt's up on the floor above her. And there's no money coming into the nursing homes. And there's no money coming into our schools. We've cut our schools for the first time ever. And now we see a bill here that I don't think there's any popular push for it. But, you know, I guess I just got to ask you, since you think this bill is so important, Representative Paulson, where is this bill in the Senate?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, I believe that the bill is in the Elections Committee currently in the Senate, and we've had three hearings already in the House, and so it's gone through some pretty lengthy discussion as we approach the committee deadline. So I know it's moving forward, and Representative Rukavina, I laid out the suggestion of the sunset provision from the standpoint of, you know, I think it was many years ago Representative Bishop in this very committee who was not a supporter of an initial referendum, but became a convert and now does support it and did support it in committee and then on the floor, brought up the very poignant case of the Buy Minnesota provision that I think many legislators before my time had voted for, but it was not a good idea, and it was the first bill to be repealed when the legislature came back in session because of the negative consequences.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
So the bill's in the Election Committee in the Senate where it will be next year as we meet here in session, correct? Because it's been in the Election Committee, I think, for the last 5 years over there. So do you expect it to get out of the Election Committee over there, or are we just beating a dead horse here again?
Well,
Representative Paulson.
Chair, Representative Rukavina, I fully expect as we continue to educate the Senate that, that they will move the bill forward.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, I apologize for not being here. This time slot, unfortunately, I'm scheduled for two meetings every week at the same time. But just a very, you know, cursorily look through the overview and the little bit of knowledge that I know about this kind of legislation in other states, particularly the state of California, where at best, I think there's a mixed bag in terms of that state's experience with this, and probably at worst, the kind of form of government that's probably bought California more headaches than it's worth. But my question is this: it seems to me, as I look at other initiative laws in other states, that as those have played out, they've come along with huge, massive investments, if you will, on the part of special interest groups to influence the thinking of the public. It's part of, as you know, our political system that goes on in any form. But I know, for instance, in Minnesota, or rather in California, that specific initiatives became the sort of the target of just huge amounts of money spent not only by people with an interest within the state, but quite frankly by a lot of folks from outside that state who stood perhaps to benefit either ideologically or perhaps financially from a decision by the people one way or the other. And so this is kind of a broad question because I take it that I would hope that we have long discussions on this bill, but it seems to me that any effort to introduce initiative and referendum in any state really ought to come along with a very aggressive and thoughtful proposal simultaneously to address campaign financing laws in order at least to be able to address what many people in the public might perceive to be the gross imbalance of power that comes with the ability to spend $1 million of your own money to influence a decision one way or the other. So I guess my question is, to what degree have you thought about in preparing this this legislation, have you thought about in terms of complementary and simultaneous campaign finance reform So that's one. I know it's a pretty broad question. And two, is that something that you're open to having a similarly in-depth discussion about as this legislation perhaps moves forward?
Mr. Chair and
Representative Paulson.
Brianna, yes, first of all, as I mentioned in the outset of my statement, the bill is designed specifically to be not like California or other states where it's very easy to get items on the ballot and where there has been quite a bit of money that's spent on the initiative process. I do think it's important to point out that studies that have been done regarding initiative campaign activity, it is really the grassroots folks who have been successful in passing their initiatives. It is not the economic interests that have been successful. In fact, even in California, I think the high watermark for initiatives was in 1998. And at that time, there were like $300 million spent nationwide on the initiative process, and $200 million of that alone was in California. I think there were some big initiatives up on the ballot that year dealing with Indian gaming and tobacco, for instance, that really drew out a lot of money. But 95% of all the money is spent on the no side. It's spent to defeat things that the people want or push for, typically, is where the money is spent for. And there's still, even with that record level in California, there's still more spent by special interest groups lobbying the legislature. Even in California, more spent lobbying the legislature than was on the initiative process. So the special interests certainly do use, you know, their ability either to circumvent campaign finance reform or whatever that proposal may be. And actually, campaign finance reform is something that Maine used to get through the initiative process and put into law. So I would suggest that, you know, for those folks who have an interest in campaign finance reform, that is an ability to do it. Because while there are individuals who can donate up to $1 million on an initiative themselves, and now in Minnesota we have individuals who can give up to potentially $1 million, you know, the 527s and caucuses perhaps, and it is a concern for campaign.
Representative Vandeveer, then Dorn. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on my friend and fellow toll road opponent, Representative Mariani's point, I do agree the last thing we'd want to see is what we saw in last election, big money being spent on elections and money from outside of the state coming in here. I'm just wondering if we also found out what a house seat costs, too. It's about $250. But with regard to this, would this change any of those parameters? I mean, it's really not directly related to that, is it? I mean, it would allow the constituents of Minnesota, the people of Minnesota, if they wanted to do that, if they wanted campaign finance reform or a particular type, then they would be able to do that, wouldn't they?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, from my perspective, certainly I could make the argument that, you know, when the governor is disdained for the legislature, he does not act appropriately or acts inappropriately on issues, that the people do have an outlet, whether it's campaign finance reform or any other issue. And that's one area I do think the beauty of this issue is it's not relegated to one set of ideologies or folks. It's really broad-based, and that's been the experience in other states.
Representative Dorn. Or, I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up, Representative Vandeveer?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Paulson, earlier in the discussion, the point raised by Representative Rukavina, and in your presentation, you alluded to something of a check and balance that what we give the voters the initiative to do, we would also retain the ability to not support that if something got, I think the phrase was used, wild and crazy. Can you tell me which provisions in the bill refer to exactly what check we would have on what a group of people might push forward and pass on the ballot? Or maybe I'm misunderstanding what you said, you know, initially. So,
Representative Paulson.
Chair, Representative Dorn, and I apologize, I'm not sure which page of the legislation it's on, I'll check, but essentially that some states do, through the initiative process, prohibit the citizen or prohibit the legislature from changing any initiated laws. And so we've been very careful about that to make it very responsible and proper here so that if there were adverse consequences, that at least the legislature would have the ability to go in and have, through a sunset provision after a two-year period, go in and make adjustments. And so I think that again, is responsible, balanced, and fair. Of course, if the legislature is doing that from the standpoint of usurping the will of the people, then there could be some consequences in the election, the next election down the road. I think legislatures would be very conscious and deliberative about that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
All right. I see no further questions. I'm sorry, Representative Clark. Representative Wagenius.
You both come on black today.
Well, I saw a disembodied hand down there, and I thought it was Representative Clark's, but it was yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paulson, this body will pass things that are popular with the people. If we understand something is popular, we'll pass it. So by its very nature, whatever is going to be addressed by initiative and referendum is going to be at least unpopular in some segments of the population. So you are going to have money contests here. I think Representative Mariani brings up an excellent point. So you're going to have a proposal that folks are going to spend a lot of money to get on the ballot. What is your estimation of cost back and forth and a ballot initiative in Minnesota? I mean, we're not the size of California, so I don't have a way to think about the cost, but are each side going to spend in the range of what?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, I've had no conversations with any groups about supporting the initiative process, you know, to pass it on the ballot, because it would have to go to the ballot in 2006, and so I've had no conversations with how much would be spent for or against. I assume there would be some money spent.
Representative Wagenius.
I'm sorry. Representative Paulson, I was not making myself clear. I'm going to assume that this passes on the ballot. Now we have something that is obviously unpopular with a large segment of Minnesotans, or we would have passed it because we do what the people want if there is something is fairly popular. So when your first, when the first initiative comes up and so, and a group has to respond to that initiative, what are the dollar amounts that you expect will need to be expended by both sides to either get the initiative through or to block the initiative? And the reason I ask this question is that we're not the size of California, or we're a different size state with a different media market, but we need to understand what costs are involved with your proposal to the public.
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Guinness, I'm not sure that there are any costs associated with the public. Obviously, an initiative could be centered around any issue, be it campaign finance reform or the environment or something else, and so it would be completely up to the initiative sponsors or potentially opponents, as you laid out, to either organize it against it or perhaps to vote and raise resources, which would not be new. I think historically it's just important to point out that 95% of all the money is spent on the no side to stop something that the people do want. And again, studies that have been done show that it takes more than just economic interest to pass something. It takes true popular support, and there is no doubt that there is also a higher voter turnout of 5 to 7%, which I don't think any of us would be displeased to see.
Representative Wagenius.
Still, Representative Paulson, you're not answering my question. If something were popular, we would pass it. So whatever is going to be put forward by initiative is going to be unpopular with some force that I put through. Since we've been doing very poorly by the environment in the last years, I was to work on an environmental initiative, and some chemical company, maybe outside of Minnesota, maybe outside the United States, decided they didn't like my proposal. What do you think I'm going to have to spend, and what do you think that chemical company is going to have to spend?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, that's just not a question that I can answer. I'm not sure anyone in this room could answer. I'm not sure the track you're headed down.
One more, Representative Wagenius.
Yes, well, you did talk about lobbying costs, and this is like it's a freebie to the public. It is not free. And I'm trying to get a grasp of, when I talk to my constituents about it, that if we're not doing our job here and passing something that the public wants, and we know through polling, we know what's popular and not, and sometimes we don't do what the public wants. If we had say to the public, no, you got to do it on your own because we didn't do it, I want to know the price tag to the public to go this route rather than relying on their legislature.
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, I think it depends on what the initiative is that's brought forward and the grassroots support that would be mobilized around such. It's possible you could have an issue passed with 100% support, I suppose, on the ballot, although it's very inconceivable. But
inconceivable.
We've had issues, you know, that have passed with 70% plus in Minnesota that the legislature's put on the ballot, so I see no reason why it wouldn't be any different.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paulson. You know, a few years ago, I forget what committee it was. I think it might have been Human Services Committee, and some of you might remember this. It was a bill that attempted to, and I'm only remembering the broad outlines of it, attempting to direct the University of Minnesota to invest in a particular type of diabetes research or treatment or something. I can't quite remember what it was. It was the kind of issue that, at first glance, I thought was pretty darn righteous, and I heard some gut-wrenching testimony from people affected by diabetes. However, at the end, most of us on that committee wound up voting against that particular approach after we spent quite a bit of time listening to both sides on a pretty complex issue. And we basically came down on the side of not wanting to be overly prescriptive to university in terms of what kind of research it should do, and where we were also concerned that directing limited state dollars to research A was going to do great damage to research B and C and others. You know, there's a reason why we're a deliberative body and we have representative government, and it seems to me that was one of the best lessons I learned about that. And I shudder to think, quite frankly, and if I get accused of being, you know, afraid of the public, you know, if that's going to be the mischaracterization of my statement here, then so be it. But I shudder to think that we might have similar type of highly complex issues put out in initiative referendum that, quite frankly, are going to wind up being influenced not by deliberative discussions like we had in that committee in a bipartisan way, but quite frankly by whether side A or side B has an extra $1 million to put together a pretty darn emotional, influential commercial folks who may be spending 10 seconds or 30 seconds out of that particular day to think about that issue might be reached. It seems to me that there's an accountability issue here, and I'm not casting any stones at you, Representative Paulson. I'm just raising the issue that right now, while it's true, as you stated, that when it comes to the issue of campaign finance reform, people do spend a lot of money here in the legislature to influence our decisions one way or the other, but you know, at the end of the day, it's each one of us who are going to be held accountable for that decision. It isn't going to be the lobbyists, it isn't going to be the special interest group, it isn't going to be the deep pocket mystery man out there with a particular axe to grind who's going to be held accountable. It's going to be you or me, and so be it. I mean, I accept that. In a system similar to what you're proposing, I don't know how we hold that mystery man accountable. I don't think you can. And so I think we need to really think seriously, in addition to some of these other issues, the issues of accountability. And I would hope that we don't get into, quite frankly, what I think are pretty simplistic ways to talk about this stuff that would mischaracterize any one of us as quote-unquote not trusting the public. I think every one of us here trusts the public pretty heavily. That's why we do the work that we do and why we put our names on lawn signs and knock on doors and have to face irate neighbors and sometimes say no to close friends of ours. You know, I don't have any problem with accountability, but I really seriously think that these kind of proposals, at the very least, need to be much more serious about how we limit the influence of money in the decision-making processes, precisely because it's hard to hold people accountable unless they themselves are elected individuals. And so I don't have a question. I just sort of wanted to respond to both Representative Lagunas' comments and your response to my question, and hope that you seriously think about these issues.
Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a question of the author, and there are essentially two parts to the question. I'd like to know, first of all, who supports the bill? I'm speaking now of some of the organizations that might line up and support. And then I'd also be interested in who the author has found in opposition to the bill. You know, for example, what's the status of or standing of the business community?
Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Carlson, I'm not aware of any organizations that are supporting the measure, other than I know we've had all the testimony we've had actually in the committee so far. It's been citizens that have come forward supporting it. Actually, I have not organized testimony from parties. I mentioned the parties who are supportive, political parties, but I've not organized testimony. But there have been citizens that have come forward on their own. And actually, in the opposition camp, it has primarily been special interest lobbying organizations. Business organizations, AFL-CIO, Education Minnesota, typically the special interest groups, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked that question, this issue has been before us many times through the years. In fact, years ago it was put to a vote of the people, and the people rejected it back when Governor Cui was in office. But yeah, I know in the past, as the author just mentioned, groups like the AFL-CIO, the League of Women Voters, I think was one that you didn't mention, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Partnership, the list goes rather long in terms of those groups that have expressed concerns about this particular proposal, both in its present form and as it's been before us in the past. Thank you.
I see no other questions. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask the author if there are any elements of our state laws or constitution that would be off limits to change by the initiative and referendum.
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, not that I'm aware of.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
So, I guess I'm concerned about any people who are in a minority position in our state, citizens, could lose their civil rights, their access to employment, to education, to public services, and so on, if a majority decided that by initiative and referendum that they were undeserving.
Representative Paulson.
Representative Clark, yeah, in terms of constitutionality and protection of rights, the process would be no different than from the legislature passing something, so the courts obviously would have a role in determining that.
Mr. Chair, not quite sure.
Representative Clark.
The last part of what you said, you're saying that sometimes the initiative and referendum could be appealed to a court and could be declared unconstitutional, is that what you're saying?
Representative Paulson.
Representative Clark, that could be the case, as is the case now with the legislature currently. If we passed a law, the legislature passed a law, it could be appealed, yes.
Representative Paulson, any last words on your bill before we vote?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right, seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 820 be referred to the Committee on Rules as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The chair is in doubt and will ask for a division. All in favor, raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. All right. By a vote of 19 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does prevail and the bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we will move back to overviews to state government finance.
Somebody had already predicted that. I don't know what our board is. I can't remember what we were doing.
Ms. Roberts, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Helen Roberts. I'm from the House Fiscal Analysis Department, and I staff the State Government Finance Committee. You should have a packet of handouts that's entitled State Government Finance Overview, and I'll be referring to that and working off of that. Mr. Chair, members, the State Government Finance Committee oversees and appropriates funding for over 20 state agencies and boards, and also the legislature and the constitutional offices. And you'll see on the first page of the packet there's a list of these different accounts. Again, there's the legislature and constitutional offices. The state agencies that fall under this committee are the major state agencies, major staff agencies, such as the Department of Finance, Department of Revenue, Administration, Employee Relations. There's also the Military Affairs Department and Veterans Affairs Department and the small veterans service organizations and a variety of small, much smaller agencies. The committee also has oversight over the gaming agencies, such as the Gambling Control Board, the Lottery and the Racing Commission. This session, there were four councils that were just moved into this committee, so they're new to the committee. That is the Asian Pacific Council, the Black Minnesotans Council, Chicano Latino Affairs Council, and the Indian Affairs Council. And finally, the committee also has oversight over the various pension funds. To start with, the committee's appropriations make up only about 1.9% of the state's general fund budget. And I know you've seen this chart before. Mr. Reinholtz had it in his previous presentation, the color pie chart. And I didn't duplicate it for you. I should note that this percentage has been declining, but I think that's due to many different things. Some accounts have been moved out of this area. Most of the change is due to the fact that other areas are growing, and I think it's fair to say that the trend for state government finance is not one of growth in the general fund area. That said, the general fund does account for 93% of the committee's direct appropriations, but the general fund is actually a much smaller percentage of the committee's overall spending, which we'll look at a little more detail in a moment. Another point I wanted to make is that the State Government Finance Committee, despite its name, does not actually fund all of state governments in terms of agency operations. At times, that's been a little confusing, and I think mostly to people outside of the legislature that see this committee's name and think that it funds the entire state bureaucracy, and that's not true. However, the agencies that are funded through this committee are the major staff agencies that provide the basic infrastructure for state agency business operations. For example, the committee funds the Department of Finance, which runs the state's accounting and payroll systems and also does, puts together the budget proposals for the governor and then oversees the budget execution. The committee funds the Department of Employee Relations, which negotiates labor contracts and also runs the state employee insurance program. And another agency that's funded through this committee is the Department of Administration, which oversees state contracting and procurement. Provides real estate management services and also provides services such as telecommunications and computing services on a fee-for-service basis. And I should also note that despite the point I just made that the committee does not fund all state government, in recent years, when the legislature and governor have decided to make what are often known as across-the-board reductions, those reductions were made in the State Government Finance Committee, and then the reductions were then allocated back to agencies that were not within this committee's jurisdiction. For example, in fiscal year 2003, there was a $17.6 million general reduction that was enacted by the legislature, and authority was given to the Department of Finance and the governor to allocate that cut, and those cuts were allocated to all state agencies, not only those that were in the committee's jurisdiction. Going on to page two, there's an all-funds summary pie chart, and then some detail on the major funds that make up this committee's direct, open, and statutory appropriation. And one point I want to make here is that this pie chart is a little different presentation than what you would see in the consolidated fund statement, which I know this committee has looked at before, because it does also include the internal service funds, which are all within the Department of Administration, and the state employee insurance fund. These are funds that are not directly appropriated by the State Government Finance Committee. In fact, for the most part, the appropriations that fund these different operations are appropriated in other finance committees. And I'll get into that a little more detail with an example from the internal service funds after we get done with this chart. And just to go really quickly through this, and if you have any questions, I can tell you what makes up most of these funds. The State Employee Insurance Fund obviously is the fund for the State Employee Insurance Program, and that is made up not only of the state employer contributions, but also of employee premiums and investment earnings. And that would be the largest fund for this committee. Secondly is the general fund, which I'll provide more detail in on this in a second. The internal service funds are, again, all within the Department of Administration, and those are funds that provide various services, telecommunications, office supplies, surplus services. There's a variety of these funds, and they're all done on a fee-for-service basis. There are federal funds that are appropriated by this committee. The largest amount are for the Department of Military Affairs, and there are also some within the Department of Administration and the Attorney General. The Special Revenue Fund, again, a wide variety of accounts make up the Special Revenue Appropriations in this committee. Some of the major ones are within the Department of Administration, the Facilities Repair and Replacement account, and also the Parking account. And then also to note that both the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission were moved off the General Fund in the 2003 session and into the Special Revenue Fund, which means they're now supported solely by fees, license fees and other fees that are imposed by those organizations. The State Government Special Revenue Fund, the majority of that is the Building Codes Activity and Department of Administration. The Workers' Compensation Special Fund, that is within the Office of Administrative Hearings for the Workers' Comp Judges. General Fund Statutory represents the Attorney General's Office Partner Agency Agreements. And then the next two funds, the Highway User Tax Distribution and Healthcare Access Fund, the majority of those expenditures are within the Department of Revenue, and they represent the costs of collecting and administering those taxes. Well, no questions. I'll move on to the general fund chart, which is on page three, to give you an overview of where the major general fund accounts are in this committee. And you'll see right away that the largest account or agency within state government is the Department of Revenue, which accounts for 31.3% of the committee's direct and open general fund appropriations. And then the second largest account, or not agency, is the legislature itself, making up 19.4% of the committee's expenditures. The major staff agencies, apart from revenue, our admin, finance, and Department of Employee Relations are another almost 15%. And then the constitutional offices make up 13.6%. And finally, I also wanted to point out the pension aides are almost 9.5%. This is aid tracked in this committee and appropriating this committee for first-class teacher state aid to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then there's a smaller amount that goes to the Minnesota State Retirement System for legislative and constitutional pensions.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, under the legislative portion of your breakout here, $116 million, What does that include? Obviously, that's not our salaries. I mean, they're a small part of it, I'm sure, but what all does that include in there?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, that $116 million is the total operating budget for the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which would be the Revisor's Office, the Library, the Legislative Auditor, and a variety of other commissions.
Representative Beard.
That would include the revisors, the folks who take care of the parking ramps, everybody that touches what we do here in the legislature, the clerk's office, and so on and so forth.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it would include, yes, the revisor, the clerk's office. As far as actually for the parking ramp and the care of this facility, the state office building is under the custodial control of the Department of Administration.
Oh, okay.
And they are responsible for it, and we provide direct funding to the department for all of the operations of this building.
Okay, Ms. Roberts, please continue.
Mr. Chair, the only other comments I wanted to make, just again in terms of trends in the general fund, is that the general fund base for this committee has declined by 8.7% from the 2002-2003 biennium. And there aren't a lot of trends to talk about for this committee, unlike other committees, in terms of overall policy goals. We don't have environmental trends or public safety trends to talk about. So. And then on page four, that's just additional information. The pie chart before that had several of these smaller agencies rolled up into one piece to make it clear to read, and this chart on page four provides all of the detail on the different agencies and accounts that are included in this committee. Moving on to page five, I had referenced earlier the internal service funds within the Department of Administration. Again, these are funds that provide services on a fee-for-service basis to other state agencies and also, in some cases, to other governments, local governments, and some MNSCU, in some cases, school districts. And in at least one case, for the bookstore, actually to the general public because they provide publications and other documents to the general public for sale. And the chart on page five is just to show you that these funds make up an additional $318.4 million that the State Government Finance Committee has oversight, even though they do not directly appropriate those funds. They do have oversight over the function of these different internal service funds. And again, you'll see that the InterTech Fund, which provides telecommunications and computer services, is by far the largest of these internal service funds at $158 million. And then just one final example on page six to further break down the Intertechnology Fund for 1 year to show you, again, this kind of story that the funding for these different internal service funds actually impacts other committees and agencies that are funded by other committees. For fiscal year 2005, the forecasted revenues, this is from the business plan presented by the Department of Administration, you'll see that the Department of Human Services makes up almost 40% of InterTech's business, which means that those funds are coming from funds that were appropriated in, I believe, Representative Gunther's committee. It will now be to the Department of Human Services, and then they're paying InterTech for different, for their telecommunications and their computer services. And you also see then Department of Finance is also a large customer that is for the operation of the state accounting system and the various systems that finance runs. But public safety is another large customer, and I believe that most of the bulk of this is due to the CJIS criminal justice information system. It's kind of bumped them up to one of the major customers of InterTech.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, Human Service, of course, buying a lot of InterTech stuff, but do we have any idea what they would be paying if they weren't buying it from InterTech? Same with public safety or anybody. Is this actually a savings?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I think I'd have to answer that in a pretty general way because there are so many different products that are involved here, and the InterTech does provide a complicated rate package depending on what the product is, and I know they do try to benchmark against the private sector. And also, in general, state agencies are able, they're not required to use the Internal Service Fund for whatever service they're looking for. So they would be able to go out and look for some more product in the private sector. I would say in general, and I don't want to get too deep into this because if we get into telecommunications, then I'll be way over my head. But I think there are circumstances where it makes it difficult for a state agency not to use InterTech. It may be because they've already invested so much in a product or through the computing services, and it would be difficult for them to back out of that. There may be certain advantages that happen in the telecommunications area from being on with other state agencies. I could probably provide you more information on that, but I don't, on an individual product basis at this point, I'd be a little bit over my head on that.
Okay, please continue.
And finally, I'm on to the last two pages of the handout, which provides some general information on the governor's recommendations for this committee. And again, I'm not here to present these recommendations, but I did think that this committee would want to know what they are. On page 7, this is the change items only for the committee for all funds. And I think you'll notice that the general trend, again, is negative. The only increases that are being recommended, at least on the general fund side, are for the Veterans Affairs Department and the Small Veteran Service Organizations and also the Military Affairs Department that's funding for the different enlistment incentives. You'll also, back at the top of the page, you might want to note that one of the major reductions is actually to the legislature itself. This takes the form of both an operating reduction similar to that recommended for the other constitutional offices, but also a depletion of 100% of the unobligated amount in the legislature's carry forward account as of January.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Roberts. Members, I think that we can still fit in Mr. Walls and his transportation finance presentation. We'll probably go over a little bit, but then we can have this one out of the way, too. So, Mr. Walls, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee, and we're distributing your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Walls, House Fiscal Analysis Department. And, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll try to move through the presentation very quickly. There are two items that should be passed out, and one is there's a packet of materials entitled Minnesota Transportation Finance Basics, and then there's a second sheet that is just a short detailed chart of the governor's constitutional MVEST dedication proposal. Mr. Chair, I'll start on the inside first page of the packet that's being handed out. And just talk a little bit about the Transportation Finance Committee accounts. The Transportation Finance Committee is appropriating about $3.7 billion in direct appropriations on a biennial basis. Of that amount, the overwhelming majority are from statutorily or constitutionally dedicated receipts. Only $80 million of general fund money per year are expended through the committee. The rest of the roughly $1.8 billion annually would be from dedicated accounts. We also do, of those dedicated funds, we receive about $320 million of MVEST money, which had formerly been deposited in the general fund. That's used as backfill for items that had been passed in previous legislative sessions, like the property tax relief for levies on the metro area for Metropolitan Council transit operations, as well as rural property tax levies for Greater Minnesota Transit, and backfill for tab cuts that were part of Governor Ventura's discretionary spending in the one-third, one-third, one-third budget agreement. Mr. Chair, the Transportation Finance Committee essentially appropriates money to three different state agencies, or two state agencies, and I believe Metropolitan Council is a quasi-state agency. The first is the Department of Transportation, and there are several offices within the Department of Transportation that receive money. The first is the Aeronautics, or the Office of Aeronautics. Their general funding that comes from the State Airports Fund, which is derived from three primary sources. One is aircraft registration fees, which are a tax levied on 1% of the depreciated value of an aircraft. There's also the aviation fuel tax, which starts at 5 cents per gallon, and there are refunds offered against the aviation fuel tax that you pay based on your usage. There's also the air flight property tax, which is property tax placed on aviation properties, I believe, on airport lands. And those three sources each year are then tallied, and the appropriation amounts for the aeronautics program are set. The aeronautics program is primarily for aviation aids to pilots, private pilots, such as the weather service reports and things of that nature, as well as construction and operation grants for the airports outside of the MAC system. And these would be airports that roughly lie outside of the metropolitan area. Mr. Chair, moving on, the Department of Transportation also receives funds for Greater Minnesota Transit, which I will talk about later. The Office of Freight deals with mostly dedicated funds, and they do some regulation on trucking companies as well as administer programs for railroads and waterways. Those funds primarily come from GEO bonds for port development assistance and railroad improvement loans. Those GEO bonds are then either loaned out or granted out to make improvements to those transportation systems. The largest expenditure is for state roads, and that can be in the form of construction, engineering costs, and also maintenance such as plowing and pothole filling. The Department of Transportation also has an Office of Electronic Communications. This office is in charge of the state's electronic communications backbone and is responsible for providing the 800 megahertz system backbone upkeep in the metro area, as well as expanded communications when that system moves into the outstate areas. But the backbone that they provide, the radio towers and the base stations, serve the State Patrol, Metropolitan Council Transit, MnDOT's fleet, as well as other users. Mr. Chair, there's also an Office of Local Roads, which divvies up some of the money that comes in from the state transportation trust funds and sends those out to counties and cities to perform maintenance and construction on their local roads. And finally, there is some additional money for the department's administration. Mr. Chair, moving down to the Metropolitan Council, there are three main functions for Metropolitan Council Transit are the regular route service, Hiawatha LRT service, and Metro Mobility. There are some other smaller services provided for community-based and opt-out communities as well, but I'll try to touch on those in a moment. Mr. Chair, the Transportation Finance Committee also has certain accounts within the Department of Public Safety. Those are the non-judicial or crime-related accounts within public safety, including their administration, the State Patrol, Capital Security, Driver and Vehicle Services, which does all the transactions for vehicle sales, license plates, licensing drivers, testing drivers, title transactions, etc. The Department of Public Safety also is in charge of the Office of Traffic Safety and Pipeline Safety. These offices try to promote traffic safety and pipeline safety both through dedicated accounts and federal funds. Mr. Chair, moving on to the next page, I'm going to get into sort of the nitty-gritty of funding for highways as well as some funding for transit through the use of this flowchart. Mr. Chair, the gray shaded areas are the main revenue sources for highway funding and, again, some transit funding. Starting at the upper left, the motor fuels tax is currently collecting about $640 million a year. The current motor fuels tax rate is 20 cents per gallon. That raises $32 million per penny of tax placed on a gallon of gasoline. Below that, on the left, Mr. Chair, the registration or tab fees is currently collecting $466 million. And this is the license tab fees you buy every year that's based on a calculation based on the value of your vehicle on a depreciating scale. Below that, there are other revenues. These include patrol fines, driver license fees, and all the title and transaction fees that you would pay at a deputy registrar or state exam station. And that totals $54 million. Those three fees, along with the other shaded area, the MVEST, 30% that's statutorily dedicated to the highway user, all flow into that center box, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. And that is essentially a fund that collects those revenues and then distributes it between the state, the counties, and the cities. The Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is 95% constitutionally dedicated, and 5% of the distribution is set in statute, which can be changed no more often than every 6 years. It was just changed about 6.5 years ago and is now up for the possibility of change this year. The final 5% dedicated by statute is currently 30.5% to the town road account, 16% to the town bridge account, and 53.5% to a flexible account, which can be determined by the commissioner to either flow towards county turnback projects or, I believe, the trunk highway fund. Mr. Chair, those highway user tax distribution funds total about $1.34 billion annually, and those flow to the right into the three separate funds between the state and the locals. The Trunk Highway Fund receives, after the constitutional and statutory formulas are considered, about 59% of the revenues, totaling about $789 million per year. The county state aid on the middle box on the upper right receives about $436 million a year. The county state aid highway formula is distributed to counties based on a statutory formula which says that 10% should be given to each county as an equal share. 10% is based on vehicle populations within that county. 30% based on lane miles within the county, and 50% on money needs. Mr. Chair, below that, roughly about 8.5% flow to the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund on an annual basis. These are for city streets. The total for the current year, I believe, is about $114 million, and that is determined 50% based on population and 50% based on money needs. Mr. Chair, these two formulas, the county formula flows about 80% to outstate Minnesota and 20% to the metro area, but that is mainly because 80% of the mileage exists, of the county state aid highway mileage exists outside of the metro area. Conversely, of the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund, about 80% flows to the metro area, and that is basically for the same reason. Mr. Chair, in that middle gray box label.
Mr. Walls, before you get to that, why, this is, I think, the 6229-9 formula that we hear about.
Correct.
In the Constitution. Why, when I look at $1.34 billion and I multiply it by 62%, 29%, or 9%, why don't I get 62%, 29%, or 9% instead of the 8.5%, 58%, whatever else it was?
Mr. Chair, the 62299 is the constitutional formula of which 95% of the money is dedicated. The remaining 5% adjusts that total slightly. And for internal purposes, MnDOT uses the formula 58.9 for the trunk highway, 0.0855 for the municipal state aid streets, and I'm not sure, I think it's 0.3255 for county state aid or whatever the plug number would be.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, continuing on the motor vehicle sales tax, the current formula dedicates 30% up into that highway user tax distribution fund, and the rest is flowing in the three boxes below. 1.43% to the Minnesota or Greater Minnesota Transit, and that is to make up for their property tax levies, which were eliminated, I believe, in 2001. That currently totals about $8.1 million a year. The general fund still receives about $262.7 million, and, Mr. Chair, I think that is, as of the November forecast, that should be down slightly, I believe, a few million dollars to I can't compute that, but I believe that's about $13 million too high. That's a November forecast number. But they receive about 46.25%. Mr. Chair, Metro Transit currently receives 21.5% or $122 million a year from motor vehicle sales tax. This current formula is set to continue until 2008, at which point it will change to 46.25 to the general fund, 32% to the highway user, 1.25 to Greater Minnesota Transit, and from 21.5 to 20.5 for Metro Transit, unless changed by the legislature.
I'm sorry, when does that happen, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is fiscal 2008.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, moving on to the next page. And
Mr. Walls, before we move on to the next page, I think what I'm going to do here is go ahead and adjourn the meeting. I know that some people have pre-session briefings at 2:30, and we're running a little bit low on members. You've got a lot of additional information here to cover. Maybe I can have you back next time to finish off the rest of it.
Thank
you. Okay, with that, members, we will probably have a meeting Thursday after session to take up some other business. I'll let you know more on that in the near future. See, no further discussion or questions. Meeting's adjourned.